White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew, welcome to tonight's program. It is January 30th, 2014, and I am Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm the other guy.
Yes. And Hadding and I are reading Chapter 77 tonight, or he's reading it, and we're back to the protocols again, Hadding. How does that make you feel?
And, oh, no!
help! But you're still going to read it, and we're in the economic area, and a lot of these things that are said in this chapter tonight have been said before, and so they obviously feel that it's important, and they're going back over it again. So I think it's not, you know, I recognize a lot of things from almost hearing it just about exactly the same from earlier in the book, but. There's a lot of other stuff, too, along with it. And it's also 4,650 words, which is one of the longer that we've ever have
yep.
here. And plus, there's a couple of quotes to start with. So I think we better just get started, huh?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Who is James Russell Lowell? Do you know that?
Oh, isn't he one of those... early Americans, something like, oh, I, no,
Some
I,
famous I'll, guy.
I'll look him up right now.
Yeah. James Russell Lowell always declared that he was of Jewish ancestry, that he was of Jewish extraction and proud of his ancestry.
Hey, you're sounding, have that funny sound again. I hope it's not your connection. Are you?
All right. How's it sound? Am I doing all right now?
That sounds better.
Okay, just keep the mic farther away.
Okay.
Let me try again. Take two. James Russell Lowell always declared that he was of Jewish extraction and proud of his ancestry. If anybody has achieved an exceptionally high grade in a difficult course, he or she was probably Jewish, says the Syracuse Jewish Monthly.
Okay, James Russell Lowell is what I kind of felt. He is a poet, American Romantic poet, critic, editor, and diplomat, born in 1819 and died in 1891. And he was in New England and amongst the writers and poets there. So that's even back then, he was commenting on, he was Jewish. Oh. He's Jewish. Well, there's a picture of him. He's got dark hair, curly, and a dark kind of curly beard. Very long. All right. Too bad. His name doesn't sound Jewish, but there he is, Jewish extraction. Let's see what it says.
I've heard stories that the Puritans had a significant Jewish faction among them, but I don't know.
Yeah, well, they don't call him Jewish, you know, and their thing up above, but probably somewhere it might say that. Anyway,
all
right. Read it all now. That's enough.
Moving on now.
Yeah.
Chapter 77, The Economic Plans of International Jews. The strength of Jewish money is in its internationalism. It stretches a chain of banks and centers of financial control across the world and plays them on the side of the game that favors Judah. This center was, and for the moment is, in Germany, at Frankfurt on the Main, but feverish anxiety now accompanies the fear that it may have to be moved. Destiny is overtaking the Jewish world power. The gold, which is their god, the god of the living is what they call their gold, is being brought overseas on every available ship and locked up in the vaults of Jewish bankers in North and South America, not to enrich this hemisphere, but to mobilize Jewish financial power for any desperate stroke. Financial Jewry is afraid. It has a right to be afraid. Its conscience, still bloody from the war, whose gains have not yet stopped, is in a troubled state. Single Jewish banking houses in any country, however great such banks should grow, would be no menace. In spite of the fact that the richest bankers in the world are Jews, as mere bankers in their several countries, they would not occasion alarm. In straight out-and-out banking, the Jew is not a success. The Rothschilds were never bankers in a proper sense. They were moneylenders to nations whose representatives they had corrupted to seek their loans. They did business precisely on the plane of the rich of the money lender in the side street, who induces the rich man's son to borrow a large sum, knowing that the father will pay. That is scarcely banking. Brands of that sort may get money, but will not make money. The deposit banking of the world is not done in Jewish banks anyway, even Jewish depositors preferring banks which are managed by non-Jews. It is not, therefore, the success of the individual Jewish banking house that concerns us. Flabby-minded non-Jews who have been blinded by pro-Jewish propaganda find difficulty in seeing that point.
Okay, do you have a, I hate to interrupt it right here, but do you have anything else you can turn off? Because I think it is a little bit of the Skype connection that's, it's not bad, but it's, you know, it's a little distorted here and there.
Anything I can turn off? I mean, like,
you know,
on my computer.
You always say, yeah, I can, I'll turn this off, I'll turn that off. I don't know, it doesn't always help, but.
Yeah, there are a few things.
Okay, yeah. We'll see.
Another thing there. And I can turn this off here. Turn off the antivirus.
Alright. Flabby-minded non-Jews he's talking about. Flabby-minded non-Jews who have difficulty understanding what the Jewish banking is all about. Okay, you ready?
Okay, am I sounding okay?
Yes.
Alright. Alright. Flabby-minded non-Jews who have been blinded by pro-Jewish propaganda find difficulty in seeing that point. They say that the individual Jewish businessman has as much right to his business success as has anyone else, which is a perfect Jewish platitude. Certainly he has. Whoever has stated that he had not? But when you are dealing with a world chain of financial consulates, all of them linking up in a world system, none of them to be regarded as American banks, or British banks, or French banks, or Italian banks, or German banks, but all of them members of the Jewish world banking system, you're obviously not dealing with individuals who are trying to make a living. You are then dealing with a mighty force, for good or ill. And thus far, sad truth to know, the ill is mountainous in comparison. Nor does this Jewish banking system require that in each country a Jewish house be the most important. It is not the wealth and importance of single houses, but the wealth and importance of the world chain that gives the strength. Kuhn, Loeb & Company is far from being the most important financial house in the United States, but with its foreign connections, all Jewish, it takes on a new aspect. Kuhn, Loeb & Company is far from being the most important banking house in the United States, and yet it was an idea that came out of Kuhn, Loeb & Company's office that now dominates the monetary system of the United States. Paul Warburg, a German Jew, scion of the Jewish World Banking Group, is boosted into undue prominence and power through the pressure of banker-bought prestige in government circles. It is his connections, Jewish ones, that count. The Warburg idea in the United States, dovetailing with the Sterns, the Furstenbergs, the Sonnensteins, and the Sassoons and Samuels and Bleichröders overseas, was something to wonder at. Jewish bankers ran this war as they have run every great war. No informed Jew will deny that. Most informed Jews have boasted of it as indicating the importance of their people. Above the nations at war was an international financial committee, all Jewish, looking down upon all the ruction and blood as serenely as American Baseball League directors look down upon a pennant series. Separated, each man tied to his country by ties of undivided nationalistic loyalty, none of these would have amounted to much. United, as a supranational financial board, knowing the secrets of all the nations, conferring one with another in all sorts of ways, even during the hardest days when all communication between countries was supposed to be locked by war, deciding the duration of the war and the hour of so-called peace, these groups constitute a danger which no one doubts after once having clearly seen it. Men who can thus manipulate money in time of war can do so in time of peace. The United States is living under some of that peace manipulation now. The reader of the protocols is much impressed by the financial notes that are sounded throughout their proposals. The Jewish defense against the protocols, that they were written by a criminal or madman, is intended only for those who have not read the protocols, or who have overlooked the financial plans they offer. Madmen and criminals do not coolly dissect one monetary system and invent another, as do the protocolists. It will be worthwhile, in view of the sidelights that these articles have thrown on the money question, to recall some of the forecasts and plans made in these most remarkable documents, which have been attributed to the wise men of Zion, the world leaders of the Inner Council. When we sink, we become a revolutionary proletariat, the subordinate officers of the Revolutionary Party. When we rise, there rises also our terrible power of the purse. So wrote the great Jewish Zionist leader, Theodor Herzl, in his work, A Jewish State, on page 23. It is precisely that union of revolutionary tendencies and financial power that the world is facing now. Look at Russia, and look at the people who swarmed at Versailles and made the peace treaty. The peace treaty was written by financiers. It is the bill presented, not to a beaten foe, but to the world. Very few people have ever read it, but its operation is evident everywhere. The Jewish bankers the world over are shoveling in the gold. Is Shmuley going to appear for this?
You want me to read the protocols here?
Well, unless you want me to make it look ridiculous.
I will be the protocol. I'll be the protocol reader. This is protocol.
If I have to read the protocols, it's going to end up sounding like Ralph Rotten or something. But
Right. I'd rather not read it in that accent. So I'll read it.
Protocol six.
Okay.
Protocol six is interesting in this connection. Shmuley.
We shall soon begin to establish huge monopolies, colossal reservoirs of wealth, upon which even the big Gentile properties will be dependent to such an extent that they will all fall, together with the government credit, on the day following the political catastrophe.
Although these words were written with Europe in view, The United States not yet having been Judaized, their import is clear. By the way, there would be a lot of disagreement about that, the United States not yet having been Judaized.
All these words were written in Europe.
I was just looking at a German book yesterday from the 1850s that said that the United States was very Judaized.
Yeah, well, they might have thought so. Well, we know it was right from the start, but not everybody thought that. I think, who said this? Was this the writers who said this? Yeah, they didn't think so. They thought they were still able to get out from under the Jews. Yeah.
At the present moment, the number of business concerns in the hands of Jewish creditors through loans is very large. The Jewish idea in business is to borrow instead of making the business stand on its own feet. The trail of that idea is seen all over our land today.
Okay, so they're saying that.
Shmuley.
At the same time, it is necessary to encourage trade and industry vigorously, and especially speculation, the function of which is to act as a counterpoise of industry. Without speculation, industry will cause private wealth to increase and tend to improve the position of agriculture by freeing the land from indebtedness for loans by the land banks. It is necessary for industry to deplete the land both of laborers and capital, and through speculation transfer all the money in the world into our hands. To destroy Gentile industry, we shall, as an incentive to this speculation, encourage among the Gentiles a strong demand for luxuries, all enticing luxuries.
There is the idea. Extravagance and debt support the Jewish moneylender's power. He does not lend to build in... Well, let me just say, that first sentence of this paragraph here is actually very true, insofar as extravagance and debt are what keep capitalism going. We get one debt bubble after another.
Real capitalism doesn't depend on extravagance and debt. Not real capitalism.
If you read Lawrence Dennis, you find out that what the capitalism depended on was the expansion of the frontier and colonies. You know, new lands, new resources to exploit. When that isn't there anymore, you just get one credit bubble after another. Because when they lend out that money on interest, you know, demanding back more money than was lent, there has to be wealth coming in from somewhere. Right? Either there are new lands out there for the grabbing, or you're going to have to rob somebody. You know?
Okay.
All right. There is the idea. Extravagance and debt support the Jewish moneylender's power. He does not lend to build industry, but to drain it. Independent industrial or agricultural wealth menaces his rule. Industry must be curbed by speculation. Speculation must be encouraged by extravagance. An industrious person soon works itself, an industrious people soon works itself free of its debt slavery. Therefore, drinking Coca-Cola here.
Oh, wrong thing to drink while you're reading here. This.
Well, I had a peanut butter sandwich before, too. That's the problem, probably. All right. Sorry, folks. Therefore, invent new excitements to keep it in debt. Entice people from the farms, and so forth, all which devices are now well known to the world. Shmuley.
Oh, sorry. We will force up wages, which, however, will be of no benefit to workers, for we will, at the same time, cause a rise in the price of prime necessities, pretending that this is due to the decline of agriculture and cattle raising. Is this still the same? We will also artfully and deeply undermine the sources of production by instilling in the workmen ideas of anarchy and encourage them in the use of alcohol. Well, it seems to me, I have this little note here, that this was done in 1917-18 in Germany, or 1918 for sure, to undermine
the
working force.
You see, the thing is, though, the question that comes up is whether the role of the Jews in these kinds of things is a matter of a conspiracy to destroy Gentile society.
Well, let's not worry. Yeah. Or so if I'm just saying that this was done in Germany. That's what was done. Okay? So let's just go on. We can argue. We can have some of these other arguments later.
Yeah, well, okay, fine. That wages were forced up, that they were of little profit to the workers, that prices did rise, that the above excuses were given, that anarchistic ideas now being circulated among the workers are Jewish and are circulated by Jews, that the illicit liquor business, as once was the legal liquor business, is entirely in the hands of Jews. These things everyone knows to be true. The protocols have been in non-Jewish knowledge since 1896. The British Museum has possessed a copy since 1906. Were they written by a prophet who foresaw or by a power that foreordained? Probably just by a very observant person, I think. The Jewish world program is shown in these protocols to be largely dependent on the false economic ideas it can induce the governments and peoples to accept. The false economic ideas, not only false, but cruelly deceptive and impossible, which are being sown among the masses of the people, are the counterpart of the other false economic propaganda being sown in the upper circles of banking and government.
You know, now they're like assuming, you could say that they're taking it for granted, or that there is a Jewish world program, or they're just saying that the protocols are calling it a Jewish world program. Okay, that's what they're saying. All right.
Okay. Jewish economic ideas are quite different from the ones which Jewish thinkers put out for others to follow. Jewish bankers know better than anyone else the utter falsity of the present system, but they profit by that falsity, and they are establishing Judah by that falsity. And they will try to maintain that falsity until it brings the inevitable collapse, after which they hope to reorganize the world on Jewish monetary principles. So, at least, the protocols indicate. This bad regime is for the so-called Gentile period only. You see, this is a problem that I have regarding the protocol. He says, so, at least, the protocols indicate. That's no indication. Because it's not a real document. It's at best somebody's observation.
Well, you're that's just picking, you know. They say they're accepting the protocols as having some value, so they're saying they indicate this. Well, this is really not a good point to argue about.
Well, I'm telling you, they're using the protocols here as a proof of Jewish intentions, and that's not valid.
Okay. But up above, it says, the Jewish bankers know better than anyone else the utter falsity of the present system, but they profit by that falsity. And then I said, as the Fed bankers know the falsity of Fed Reserve System. I mean, you know, we have the bankers putting in place all these reserve systems that they run and have been for some time now, and they know the falsity of it. They have to. They're not stupid. And they know they haven't improved anything. They have not improved anybody's economy whatsoever in all the time they've been in effect since 1913. They haven't done what they promised to do, but they are they're establishing Judah by that fall. They're establishing their own power. That's all you have to see in it. You don't have to say, oh, well, what does Judah mean and so on. It means Jewish power, So that's what I say.
Yeah, well, if you say that the Jews are profiting by a bad arrangement, I mean, that's not so fantastic. You don't need the...
It doesn't have to be fantastic.
You don't need the protocol for the
learned elders. Okay, all right.
To tell you that Jews want to make money. Come on.
Okay. Well, nobody said. Nobody's saying that right here. I'm just saying that that's an example of what's being said here.
The temporary nature of the present Jewish system and the destruction it is meant to work in the world is shown in the third protocol, where, after discussing ways and means to make the lower classes hate the well-to-do, it says,
"This hostility will be still more accentuated as a result of crises, which will close stock exchange operations and stop the wheels of industry." Well, that's happened. "Having organized such a general economic crisis by all the underground means available to us, and thanks to the assistance of gold, all of which is in our hands, we will throw whole crowds of working men into the streets simultaneously in all the countries of Europe. These crowds will gladly shed the blood of those whom they, in the simplicity of their ignorance, have envied since childhood, and whose property they will then be able to loot." And this was like from, you know, right before the 1900s, supposedly, that this was being written.
"All this, as the world knows, has occurred in Europe. The weapons first used were economic. The subjection of the people, the revolution, was first economic. The Jewish program profited by the split which Jewish ideas had been able to make between the upper and lower classes of Gentile society. Divide and rule is the Jewish motto as quoted in the protocols. Divide the working class from the directing class. Divide the Catholic and Protestant churches. In brief, divide Christendom on economic, creedal, social, and racial lines, while the Jew remains a solid body, able because of his solidarity to handle a divided world." I want to make a couple of comments here. First of all, good observation about how the Jew profits from class division, the workers versus the directing class. That's what National Socialism addressed first and foremost. Also fascism to some extent, although not as successfully, I think. And there's another thing here, though, that I want to criticize, where it says divide the Catholic and Protestant churches. What he's dancing around here is the fact that the protocols actually blame Protestantism on a Jewish conspiracy. It says, "In the goy societies in which we have planted and deeply rooted discord and Protestantism." So there you go. I think we talked about that before, months ago.
Okay.
All right. So he's just dealing with this Protestantism in the protocols in a way that makes it
seem
easier to accept the protocols.
Oh, you think so?
All right. "And this plan has succeeded. Out of the disorder of the world war, look how high the government of Judah has been placed in Russia, Austria, Germany, France, Italy, England, and in the United States."
Now, is that true? Isn't that true? You have to think about it.
Talking 1921... No.
Yeah, they have gone high.
As of 1921, Warren G. Harding was the president of the United States, and there was, at that point, something of a reaction.
Oh, come on, let's not go into that. All right, after the war, after World War I, the Jews had their place much better than they ever had it before in all these countries, and they're mainly talking about Europe, but then they add the United States. But let's not go into a bunch of details about Warren Harding. At this point,
also the Jewish power in Germany after World War I didn't, you know, a lot of them. Well, okay. There were some big changes within a short time. All the Jewish bankers are still in Russia. It was only the non-Jewish bankers who were shot and their property confiscated. Bolshevism has not abolished capital. It has only stolen the capital of the Gentiles. And that is all that Jewish socialism or anarchism or Bolshevism is designed to do. Every banker who is caricatured with dollar marks on his clothes is a Gentile banker. Every capitalist publicly denounced in red parades is a Gentile capitalist. Every big strike, railroad, steel, coal, is against Gentile industry. That is the purpose of the Red Movement. It is alien, Jewish, and anti-Christian.
That's good.
I think that's accurate. As far as, the people that run these movements are mostly Jews, and the Jews, they for some reason, they just can't bring themselves to become critics of other Jews very much.
Very much. Not at all.
Well, now, one of the interesting points about the Jewish financial scheme for the future, as shown in the protocols, is the way in which it contrasts with the financial scheme which the Jewish groups now favor. As before stated, what the protocolists now advise is not what they will adopt when their present advice has worked its hoped-for results. The protocols which detail the future financial plan of Jewish control are numbered 20 and 21. Protocol 20 opens thus.
Today, we will speak of the financial program, the discussion of which I have postponed to the close of my report, as it is the most difficult, decisive, and concrete of our plans.
Throughout the recital, the protocolist harks back to the old, our present, financial system, and some of his remarks are worth transcribing here.
You know that the gold standard destroyed the governments that accepted it, for it could not satisfy the demand for currency, especially as we removed as much gold as possible from circulation.
Well, you see there, the gold standard destroys governments. That's pretty much what Adolf Hitler held.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So having a gold-backed currency, according to the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, is foolishness. We have all these patriotards that are fixated on gold-backed currency as some kind of cure-all, when it's a disease that's worse than what we have now. Whether the first statement is true remains to be seen. The others are demonstrably true. The gold in the ground and the gold that is money is under Jewish control, and they withdraw it when they will. The stupid so-called Gentile says, why should they withdraw it? They cannot make any money that way. Once again, remember the distinction. It is not a matter of making money, but of getting it. Panics are more quickly profitable than is a long period of prosperity for men whose commodity is money.
And that's what I said last week. Wasn't it last week?
Panics profitable?
Well, we were talking about that. You saying, I don't want to get into this, but you're saying that the Jews didn't like chaos, and we were reading about chaos, and I said that they did.
They like a certain chaos. Level of chaos. Sure, I heard you say that I've said something like that, and I wonder where the hell did you get that?
From what we were talking in earlier chapters of this program.
Jews require a certain degree of chaos in order to get away with their predations. If you have a very well-ordered state where people cannot be exploited by parasites, you know, that's a bad time for the Jews. So they require a certain level of chaos, not total chaos.
Oh, well, you know, you always pull this stuff, you know, like, oh, it's some chaos, but not total chaos. Well, they have to be in control of the chaos, right? That's the thing. It's chaos to other people, but they know what it's all about, and so that they're in control. So that wouldn't be totally...
They need enough law enforcement to keep themselves from being lynched.
Okay, all right. Let's go on. Indeed.
Anyway. Indeed, men who deal in money as a commodity, and on the Jewish plan, lose their prestige if prosperity continues too long. The banker who is a banker, who lives to serve industry and the community, if he profits by prosperity...
There's no F. There's no... Do you have an F?
Oh, sorry. No, I don't. The banker who is a banker, who lives to serve industry and the community, he profits by prosperity, but not so the money sharks.
We created economic crises for the Gentiles by the withdrawal of money from circulation. Mass capital stagnated. Money was withdrawn from use by the various governments, and they in turn were obliged to turn back to the capitalists for loans. Such loans naturally embarrassed the governments owing to the payment of interest charges and made them subservient to the capitalists.
The withdrawal of money from circulation will create panics. Everyone knows that. Such withdrawal of money is within the decision of a very small group of men. Ooh, the Federal Reserve Board. Here in the United States, we have been for a long 15 months witnessing such a withdrawal and its effects. The word went by wire across the land, setting a date. On that date, values began to crash all over the country, and honest bankers tried to help, while others who knew the game profited hugely. As shown in the last article, money was withdrawn from legitimate use that it might be lent to money speculators at 6%, who in turn lent it to desperate people at rates as high as 30%. No intelligent person will attempt to explain such events on the ground of natural law or of honest practice. These things occurred in this country within recent days. It is the elastic system, you know, with the public as a monkey on one end of the elastic. A splendid idea, no doubt, if administered by the non-Jewish method of doing the greatest possible good to the greatest number. But a deliberate assassination of life and property as it has been administered. The protocolists then pay their respects to governmental finance with the keenness that is well justified.
Owing to methods allowed by irresponsible Gentile governments, their treasuries became empty. Then came the period of contracting loans and using up the assets that remained. This brought all the Gentile governments into bankruptcy.
As operating groups, the governments are bankrupt now. Only their power of confiscation keeps them up. The United States, commonly referred to as the richest country in the world, is just as poor as a government as is any other. It has nothing. It is in debt and borrowing. And its creditors are constantly discounting their obligations and are putting it into worse hands than ever. Even the Liberty Bonds are almost passed out of the hands of the people into the hands of Jewish fiscal agents who get money out of the necessities of the people who sell and out of the necessities of the government which borrowed. And if all signs do not fail, we shall one day be hearing in Congress pleas for special legislation in behalf of the poor bondholders. It is to be hoped.
We've had that already, right? We've had that already.
Yeah, I think so. It is to be hoped when that day comes, someone will have mettle enough to stand up and declare who the poor bondholders are. A list should be made now for future reference.
Yeah, well, nobody did, at least not in Congress. Or maybe a few did. They used to have some pretty good people in there who would stand up and say things. Not anymore.
You have another quote from the protocols for Schmuley.
Every loan proves government inefficiency and ignorance of governmental rights. Loans, like the sword of Damocles, hangs above the heads of the rulers, who, instead of placing temporary taxes on their subjects, stretch forth their hands and beg for charity at the hands of our bankers. Essentially, foreign loans are leeches, which in no instance can be removed from the government body until they fall off of their own accord, or the government itself removes them. But Gentile governments, instead of removing them, continue to place more. They must perish inevitably through exhaustion by voluntary bloodletting.
This is the plainly expressed criticism of the Jewish world government upon the governments of the nations, and the truth of it cannot be gainsaid. It represents a statement of common wisdom upon which the Jewish world program hopes to commend itself to the common people. Who's reading this here?
Well, isn't that a quote?
This is the ignorant Gentile asking a question here, I believe.
Oh, okay. All right.
Then why do not the Jewish world financiers help the nations out of this financial policy? Why, indeed? Jewish financiers are the inventors of such loans as they here describe, the barriers to such direct taxes as they here recommend. Listen, in the same page as the above, Schmuley.
You may well understand that such a policy, although inspired by us, cannot be followed by us.
That is historically true, whether it will prove prophetically true or not. Compromising loans and interest are Jewish devices. Historically Jewish. Practically, and at present, the Jew prefers not to borrow, except in such a way as to place all business risks on other people's money, while he keeps his own safely. And the payment of interest is an abomination to him. These statements of the protocols have at least these historical and racial confirmations. The whole stupidity of the Gentile system by which Jewish international financiers are enriched is clearly set forth in the same 20th protocol.
And let me point out that he puts Gentile in quotes, and fairly often they've done that. So they're not really bashing the Gentile system, but they're saying that it appears to be the Gentile system, but it's not really, you know, working.
It's the system for the Gentiles.
Yes, right. Okay, and so the 20th protocol, what is the effect of a loan, especially of a foreign loan, other than this? A loan is the issuance of government notes, pledging interest in proportion to the sum of borrowed capital. If the loan pays 5%, then in 20 years the government has paid the interest in vain, for it is equal to the sum of the loan. In 40 years, it has paid out an amount equal to the loan twice over, and in 60 years, three times, while the original debt remains unpaid.
Now, that kind of thing really marks the protocols as not being a record of any Jewish meeting, because a Jew doesn't need to be told that 5% interest paid for 20 years equals the principal. They know that stuff. This is like an explanation for small children here.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean,
sure it is.
It's not small children. You know, I think that they're pointing out, I think they're just pointing out how this thing works, that you don't ever get ahead. So maybe you're right that the people who wrote it wanted to make that clear how the thing worked.
Yeah, for somebody that has no familiarity with interest and loans.
But the people in that meeting, if there was such a meeting, the people, there could be people in there who yeah, were not. Right. Oh, you think they're not, all Jews are not economists and money financiers. They're not.
Okay.
Okay.
Extremely simple, and yet it is the most generally ignored fact of all. We live in a democracy. Uh-oh. He said it. We live in a democracy, yet loans are contracted that always cost more than the amount of the loan, and no one has a word to say about it. We Americans do not know how much interest we pay every year, and we don't know to whom we pay it. We are still living under the lie that a national debt is a national blessing. The most delusive doctrine ever promulgated. Do you know who said that?
No, I don't.
I looked it up. It's the actual quote is, "A national debt, if it is not excessive, will be to us a national blessing." Alexander Hamilton.
That no good sneak.
Yeah, Alexander Hamilton actually attended a Jewish school when he was growing up. And his mother had been either shacked up or married to a Jew before. Alexander Hamilton's actual father was not that Jew, but, you know, some people.
Oh, wow. That all sounds kind of questionable, doesn't it? Lots of room for him being Jewish.
But he went to Jewish school as he was growing up. And
Gosh, there we go. Alexander
Charles Hamilton. Beard argues that the way the Constitution was drawn up was to secure the right of moneylenders.
Okay, well, there we go, all the way back to the beginning.
Yeah.
They're in there sneaking in. They always seem to manage to get their way, or, you know, to get, they're never found out or thrown out or anything. You know, they get their part in there. They get their stuff in there. I don't know why they're always able to do that.
The amount of our national debt is the measure of our enslavement to Jewish world finance.
It's a good line.
The reader may observe in passing that Jewish apologists, John Spargo, Herman Bernstein, and others, say that the protocols were put out by the secret police of the Russian Tsarist regime. It is very unusual, is it not, to find the Tsar's police interested in plans to remove graft from high finance and preaching doctrines exactly contrary to the established system. The reader will find some amusement in searching for Russian police spies in the further development of the Jewish financial philosophy. The purpose of Protocols 20 and 21 is not to describe the present financial chaos in which the Gentiles are encouraged to continue. That system was described in previous protocols. Their purpose is rather to describe how the Jewish world power plans to run things when the time comes. This is well worth considering, for there are portions of the plan which would be worth adopting. And some of them were adopted in Germany. The Jewish expectation of world rule is, of course, absurd, although the mass of Jews sincerely hold it. Their condemnation is that they regard every degeneracy in society as bringing them a step nearer their goal, which explains the great assistance they give to all degenerative processes. There's something in, I think, the book of Isaiah about how the Jews will win through the sinfulness of their enemies or something like that.
Well, I think that they say it's absurd to think of world rule of Jews. It certainly is not absurd. They might have thought so at the time. Again, they were very confident in the Gentile people waking up, and if things went too far, well, look how far things have gone.
Yeah, the idea that Jews should rule the world is in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Which I believe is in the public domain. Shmuley.
Oh, yes. When we ascend the thrones of the world, Such financial expediencies, not being in accord with our interest, will be definitely eliminated.
That is the opening note. It is another version of the statement. You may well understand that such a policy, although inspired by us, cannot be followed by us. What then did the protocolists looking for world power propose to eliminate?
One, the stock exchanges will be permanently suppressed, for we will not allow the prestige of our authority to be shaken by price fluctuations on our stocks. We will fix the full value legally without permitting any power to raise or lower it. Raising prices gives a pretext for lowering them, which was what we started with the stocks and bonds of the Gentiles.
Yes.
Number two, the lawful confiscation of money in order to regulate its circulation. It's lawful to confiscate money. Three, we must introduce a unit of exchange based on the value of labor units, regardless of whether paper or wood are used as the medium.
Yep.
We will issue money to meet the normal demands of every subject or citizen, adding a total sum for every birth and decreasing the total amount for every death. That's really interesting, isn't it? So they're going to have a certain amount of money in circulation, and for every new birth they add some, or every death they take the same amount away, I guess.
That's very similar to what they did in National Socialist Germany. They had that labor-based currency. And they did make sure that citizens had the money that they needed to raise families.
Why do they say whether paper or wood? When was wood?
Well, this is just a kind of a figure of speech, I guess, to emphasize that it doesn't have to be metal or backed with metal.
Yeah. Okay. Then there's a number four and a five. Number four, commercial paper will be bought by the government, which instead of paying tribute on loans as at present, will grant loans on a business basis. A measure of this character will prevent the stagnation of money, parasitism, and laziness. So they don't want any parasitism when they're in charge. Qualities which were useful to us as long as the Gentiles maintained their independence, but which are not desirable to us when our kingdom comes.
You see, that's the main theme of Gottfried Feder's manifesto, is the removal of debt paper, commercial paper, from circulation, because, as it says, people are lazy parasites living on interest.
Yeah, okay. Number five. We will replace stock exchanges by great government credit institutions whose functions will be to tax trade paper according to government regulations. These institutions will be in such a position that they may market or buy as many as 500 million industrial shares a day. All right.
The reader will bear in mind that police spies of agricultural Russia forged this document in 1896. As a gentleman remarked, if this is the forgery, what must the original have been? Editor.
Okay, that's their comment. Thus, all industrial undertakings will become dependent on us. You may well imagine what power that will give us. It's probably true. It's true already.
Yeah. The protocolist now being quoted also gives his attention to taxation. Observe again the Russian police spy doing some forging. The builders of this plan for world rule recognize that when the overturn comes, they will have to be in a good position to offer the people something extremely good in order to win their favor. This, of course, was the plan in Russia, although Russia presents no parallel to what the protocolists hope to do for what they call their kingdom. That's an interesting admission. Russia was simply tortured in punishment. Russia was a Passover offering. Russia is an example of Jewish vengeance, destruction, rage, not of the rule which international Jewry hopes to put over a world economically conquered through its own weakness and lust. Hear, then, the taxation plan.
When we become rulers, our autocratic government, as a first principle of self-protection, will avoid burdening the people with heavy taxes. It must not forget to play the part of father and protector. But as government organizations are costly, it is necessary to raise money for maintenance. Consequently, it is necessary to study carefully, in this particular, the problems of checks and balances. Two, kinds of taxes to be raised. A, the best method of taxation is to establish a progressive tax on property. B, the receipt of purchase money or an inheritance will be subjected to a progressive stamp tax. C, any transfer of personal property, whether in money or other form of value. And D, a luxury tax through the medium of a stamp impost.
Yeah. The rich are to be taxed in proportion to their wealth.
Yeah.
I think that's for you.
Oh, now I was moving around and I lost my place. Okay, I got it. To their wealth. A tax on a poor man is the seed of revolution, and it is detrimental to the government, which loses the big things in the in its pursuit of the small. I thought that sounds like Obama. But anyway.
But there are other shrewd reasons for thus taxing the rich. A.
Aside from this, the tax on capitalists will lessen the growth of wealth in private hands, where we have concentrated it as at present as a counterweight to the governmental power of the Gentiles. And B, such a measure will destroy the hatred of the poor toward the rich. They don't want that. See, when they're in charge, they don't want the hatred between the classes, who will be regarded as the financial support of the government and the exponents of peace and prosperity. The poor will realize that the rich are paying the money necessary to attain these things.
This was written at least as early as 1896. How many forms of taxation have come precisely as here outlined?
Mm-hmm.
How illuminating also the following remark.
Go ahead and read that.
Money should circulate, and to hinder free circulation has a fatal effect on the government mechanism which it lubricates. The thickening of the lubricator may stop the correct functioning of the whole machine. The substitution of a part of money exchanged by discount paper has created just such an impediment. Remember that when next you hear the Jewish plan that Gentiles shall do business with their own bits of paper while Jews keep their gold reserves safely in their own hands. If the crash comes, Gentiles have the paper and Jews the gold. If bits of paper serve ordinarily, the world may sometime decide to do away with the gold. Certainly a system which rests on cash yet works with not cash has disadvantages which depression and panic reveal. Says Protocol 22, we hold in our hands the greatest modern power, gold. In 2 days we can free it from our treasuries in any desired quantities. The Jews are economists, esoteric and exoteric. They have one system to tangle up the Gentiles, another which they hope to install when Gentile stupidity has bankrupted the world. The Jews are economists. Note the number of them who teach economics in the state universities. Says
all
Protocol
right, yeah, 8. Yes, that's it. Music is on. Thanks very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll sum this up next week.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.